inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can.
Welcome to The Lynn Show, coming to you, as you certainly know, on the Radio Ear Network. And the reason that you know that is because, since this is an internet radio station, you cannot have found this by randomly turning your dial. Not like a regular radio station. You had to intend to be on this radio station. Because, as we all know, if you hit even one letter that was not correct in the website, you wouldn't have wound up here. So you either chose to be here because you wanted to hear my show, hooray, or you were listening to the show before this, also hooray, and you haven't turned to another website or shut off your computer, or you're waiting for the show that's following me, also hooray, and you just happened to get here early. In any case, I'm delighted that you're here, and I like to say, as at some point in every show, what it is that the show is mostly about. You know, people ask me, when I say I'm doing a radio show, they say, well, what's it called? And I say, it's The Lynn Show. And they look at me a little odd, and they say, well, yeah, but what's it about? And I always laugh, you know, because it's about... Well, you know, I want to say it's about me. It's very hard for me to say, but here I am on the radio, so. It's not only about me, but it is about the things I know, or the things I believe I know. I'm fond of saying, you know, this is the gospel according to Lynn, and you don't have to believe anything I say. But I believe what I say. And it's about the things that I believe that I know, first and foremost, as a psychotherapist in practice for 30 years, I have very strong feelings about why people get stuck, why people can't do the things they want to do when they want to do them, and I wrote a book about it called When You Can, You Will, which if you've been listening at all, you know about. And I'm working my way through the book. The book builds on itself, explaining different reasons why different people get stuck. I was thinking today about the time I tried to learn Tai Chi and the time I tried to learn Greek. I started these classes. Actually, I started the Greek classes at the first class, and I took, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them. I was doing quite well. I have this odd fondness for all things Greek, although I am not Greek. And I wanted to learn the language because I knew I was going to go at some point. And I did, in fact, go. But I didn't learn the language because after the 4th or 5th class, I had to go out of town. And when I got back, I had missed a class, and I couldn't catch up. I got lost. And the same thing happened to me with Tai Chi, except in the Tai Chi class, I came along after they had learned a bunch of steps, and I'm dyslexic, and I couldn't do it. So I believe that while these may be person-specific to me, when we're learning something new, a new idea, a new concept, a new skill, we have to hear it over and over and over again. And if we miss a place, then we are likely to be thrown off track. So I spend a lot of time in these shows going over what I have talked about in previous shows, believing that if you have not been here for the past shows, this will be important for you, and that if you have, the recap will be valuable. I want to interject here that I've been doing a series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist. I've been interviewing artists and playing those interviews on the show. Last week, I interrupted that to play an interview with Sandy Kehoe about her book on Alzheimer's. And I'm going to interrupt it again today to play another interview, which I also did previously, with Charlie Bratt, who's a yoga teacher, and whose philosophy and practice of yoga is so consistent with what I believe about how people grow and change. And later in the interview, you will hear Charlie say, "So I like to do this teaching because while I'm teaching, I'm actually talking to myself. I'm grateful to the students who come because they give me some place to say this so that I can remember what I believe, what I know, and what I also forget." And this is how I feel about the work that I do. If you were listening in one of the early shows, you heard me say that when my agent first took around the book, publishers and editors said to her that it was a dangerous book, that it was against the conventional wisdom. Because I think that's insane. But then I think the conventional wisdom is insane. The conventional wisdom, which tells us that we can do whatever we want if only we want it badly enough and we try hard enough. Where there's a will, ... Because I don't believe that. As a psychotherapist, over and over and over again, people have come to see me saying, "But I want to do this differently. I want to stop doing this. This is bad for me. It hurts me. It gets in my way. It undermines me. Or I want to do something I haven't ever done. It's important to me. I've wanted to do this all my life." And these people can't do it. And it has nothing to do with how much they want it or how hard they've tried. And so having seen this over and over and over, I have made some decisions about what can stop us, even when we want it and even when we've tried. And of course, the conventional wisdom keeps telling you, don't be silly. You just either didn't want it enough or you didn't try hard enough. And because the conventional wisdom, in the form of pretty much everybody you know, not to mention the popular culture, TV, films, radios, oh my God, radio stations, books, you know, the self-help books. If you only do this, then you'll solve it. If you only take these 10 steps, then you'll fix it. If you only eat this, then you'll lose the weight. You know, I don't have to tell you. So we're continually inundated as a culture by the culture, which tells us, you know, what I think is a lie. But nevertheless, it is continually coming at us as the conventional wisdom, neither conventional nor wisdom. So I'm pushing against the sea, you know, and feel that it's essential for me to continue to give this message. If there's something you want to do, you want to go back to school, you want to move out of the state you live in, you want to leave your parents' house, you want to leave your husband, you want to get married, you want to have a child, you want to clean up your room, you want to stop biting your nails, you want to write a letter to a friend you haven't seen in a long time, you want to cut your hair, it doesn't matter. And you haven't been able to, there's a very good reason. You are not lazy or crazy or self-destructive. There's nothing wrong with you. There's a good reason. And it is possible to know the reason. And until you know the reason, just continually beating yourself up and telling yourself that you ought to be able to do it, that's going to work against you. It's going to make you feel bad. And when you feel bad, all changes are more difficult. So, I recap pretty much all the time. And in this show, I am planning to recap almost from the beginning, to talk about the stuff that I talked about earlier in the show and the concepts that I talked about more recently, and bring us up to a particular point. This work that I'm talking about now covers, these concepts, these ideas, they're in the first three chapters of the book. They're all about the family, more or less. In the audio book, they're all in disc number one. And in the workbook, they are all in part one. So I've gotten to a sort of natural break, and I'm going to recap to this break. And then starting in next week, which I believe will also be the first week in June, I'm going to pick up with chapter four in the book, which is also disc two, or the beginning of disc two in the audiobook, and part two in the workbook. So I'm going to talk about that, and then I'm going to play the interview with Charlie, which I got an opportunity to listen to as I was putting together this show, and it's really terrific. It's really terrific. Charlie is the living, breathing example of what he does. If you live in or near Sarasota and you are here in season, which is the only time we get Charlie, and you can find the Women's Resource Center, which is on Tuttle Avenue. If you can find the Women's Resource Center, you should come to the yoga classes, whether Charlie is there or not, because they are all wonderful. And they're there every morning from 9 to 10:30, and I believe on Wednesday and Thursday afternoons from 5:30 to 7. I'm pretty sure that's correct. And they're wonderful. And Charlie is there on Thursday mornings in season. So I'm going to begin to talk about what it is that gets between us and the things we want to do. One of the most powerful things keeping us from what we want to do is simply our idea of who we are. For example, if you think of yourself as a coward, well, clearly there are risks you wouldn't even consider, even if those things were things you really wanted to do. And if your dignity is important to you, then there are things you would shy away from for fear that they would leave you looking undignified. We all have ideas about ourselves, who we are and who we're not, and therefore what we can and cannot do. Any quality that we identify with limits us in some way. For example, if you think of yourself as a brave person, you might never be able to let yourself experience or appreciate the simpler, less dangerous things in life, even if you yearned for them. So the first thing we want to do is discover who we think we are. And the first place to look for that is in the family, because it was there that we learned who we were, or at the very least, who we'd better be or who we'd better not be. To begin, families are not haphazard, random collections of people. I could talk for a long time about why particular people are drawn to each other, and maybe next year I will do that. But it's not accidental. People are drawn to each other with intent. And some of that intent has to do with achieving balance, balancing what their roles are with those of another. And so when two people who have been drawn together begin a family, it is also important for the family to have balance. This balance is called homeostasis. Families need to be homeostatic. I don't really understand why families don't create members who are well-balanced within themselves, but they don't. They create members who have complementary skills. So you'll have a family with the super-achieving child and the underachieving child. You'll have the irresponsible one and the hyper-responsible one. You'll have two children who do really well in school and one who daydreams all the time. Or you'll have a whole family that is incredibly detail-oriented and one person in the family who can never remember what day it is. This has a profound effect on what each of these members can do. If you have been assigned the quality of irresponsible, it's hard for you to save money. So, the best way that I know to begin to discover the role that you've been assigned to play is to do what I call the family pie exercise. In the earlier show when I talked about this, I talked about this at length. But now I'm simply going to say, you draw a circle, you break that circle up into as many pieces as there were people in your family of origin. Mom, dad, sisters, brothers. If grandma lived with you, you include her, or if your aunt or aunt and uncle, or you include those people. And when you have a pie piece for everybody in the family, you write their names in the pie pieces, of course, including yourself. And then you write a list in each of the pie pieces of all of the qualities which you associate with that person. This might be easier to do for some people than others. You might find that you can do your parents really easily, but one of the siblings eludes you, or you can do everybody, but you can't do yourself. In any case, this is the first step in discovering what it is that stops you from doing whatever it is you want to do. So, you do your family pie, and you begin to identify qualities which were assigned to you. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, but I believe that every single quality that exists in a family system, that is, every single quality that shows up in your family pie, exists in every single person in the family. Although, obviously, some people demonstrate some of the qualities and other people demonstrate other qualities. If, for example, the qualities of irresponsibility and responsibility show up in your pie piece, somebody there can always be counted on, always does whatever they say they're going to do, you know, is the one who is assigned all the tasks, and somebody else, you know, maybe they will, maybe they won't, you can't count on them, family talks about them. It's my belief that the one who you can't count on, that one also has the capacity to be hyper-responsible. And the one who's got all the tasks has the capacity to be laissez-faire and not counted on. But they don't demonstrate that. They demonstrate what they were assigned. And this, of course, is really important for the future. If it turns out that what you need, the quality that you need in order to do the thing you want to do, belongs to somebody else in your family, it also belongs to you. The problem is that the family is counting on you to demonstrate whatever the quality was it was assigned to you. And family balance demands that you continue to behave in the way you were assigned. So that if you access the other quality, then the family balance is disturbed. There's plenty of evidence for this. You can see it when the family members have been on somebody's case to change, and then they change, and everybody's really uncomfortable. This is a well-established fact in alcoholic families, where the person who has been alcoholic, and of course everybody wants them to get sober, and then the other person feels out of a job and uncomfortable and doesn't know how to react, the balance has been disturbed. So it's not so easy, even though you have the capacity to do this other quality, and even if the family is encouraging you to change, underground, unconsciously, everybody is hoping that you stay the way you were. Because if you change, the entire balance of the family is changed, and other people will be called on to change, and they sure as hell don't want to. When people tell me that I must be wrong about this, families are not so rigidly balanced, and everybody is not holding on to their job, and people who are encouraging you really want you to change, I suggest that you try the small change exercise. It's very simple. Either within your family of origin or within the family that you're now living in, or even just with your close friends, pick some little trait for which you are well known. If you always come late, come early. If you always come early, come late. If you're kind of sloppy in the way you dress, you know, make sure everything is spit polished and neat. And obviously, vice versa. Just pick something that people are used to you behaving in a certain way, and do it differently. And then just watch what happens. The chances are good, first of all, that it will be noticed. People will pay attention. Secondly, they'll probably tease you. Teasing, you know, is a not-so-subtle way to tell you that what you're doing is to be made fun of. It's the first shot over the bow of trying to get you to do it differently, to do it the old way, to be the old you. Some people can't even do it. I have often given this exercise to people who are really careful about the way they dress, very, very attached to issues of control and looking a certain way. And then I suggest to them, the women, that they wear two different earrings, or the men, that they wear two different shoes or two different socks or something that doesn't match really badly, and they simply cannot do it. They can't break the simplest of old ways of being. So you might want to try that and see if you are really attached to your behaviors, the way you think of yourself, and if you should be able to change it, if other people are really attached to your old ways of being. One of the most powerful tools that families have to get kids to be what they want them to be for family balance is the need of children to copy or model their parents. We copy our parents, we emulate them, before we have words, before we have concepts, and before we have opinions about whether these are qualities we actually want to have or not. So if you model the parent of the same sex, which is really the best choice, because, of course, biologically you are like the parent of the same sex, then you will see yourself as that person. That's the best choice, but it is limited in the sense that once you have identified yourself as that person, if you need to do something that person isn't, you may not be able to do it. You may not see it as part of you, and even more, you may see it as a betrayal of that beloved parent. I talked a lot about this in the earlier show, and of course there's a lot more about this in the book. If for some reason when you get older you don't like the parent of the same sex, or you're afraid or embarrassed by or neglected by or abandoned by the parent of the same sex, then you are likely to have modeled the parent of the opposite sex. And while this is usually the best choice, or you wouldn't have made it at the time, you can see that there's always something wrong with it. Because biologically, you are not like the parent of the opposite sex. And so you will feel sort of out of sync. You will know that there is something not quite right. And what that something is all of the things that you share with the parent of the same sex who you have anti-modeled. And again, if what you want to do later in your life requires a quality that the anti-modeled parent had, well, you will have a strong taboo against using that quality, even if it's the one you want. I had a client once whose mother was a wonderful businesswoman, and this client toyed with any number of different vocations and occupations. She was, I think, 35 or 40 before she finally decided, oh, hell, I'll open a business. Because, of course, she could do it. She had all those skills from her mother, but she really didn't like her mother. And it took her a very long time to be able to accept that she could be in any way like her mother. So that's modeling and anti-modeling. And a way you can tell, a shorthand for finding out who you've modeled, is to look at your family pie. And if many or all of the qualities that you wrote in your pie piece are also in the pie piece of your same-sex parent, you probably modeled that parent. And if they're not there, but they're in the pie piece of your other sex parent, then you probably modeled your other sex parent. Okay, the last way to look at this idea of who I am and in what way am I limited is to look at your cover story and your undercover. But before I describe the concepts of cover and undercover, I'm going to play the interview with Charlie. It'd be nice for you to hear a different voice for a little while. And then hopefully there'll be enough time for me to talk about that after the interview. So now, here's my interview with Charlie Brott. All right, I'm sitting here with Charlie Brott, and I'm sitting here in his lovely lanai, which feels so peaceful and so right for Charlie. Charlie is a yoga teacher, at least that is how I know him. And he teaches at the place that I take classes. And I wanted to interview Charlie for the program because he does what he calls the yoga of letting go. And that is so consistent with how I feel about pretty much every human endeavor, that we can't force it, that allowing, that making space for, that accepting is really what leads to change, and not pushing and forcing, which is so common, so
American.
So you took the word right out of my mouth.
Grit your teeth and try harder.
Exactly. I quote something I learned when I was a child. Good, better, best. Never let it rest until your good is better and your better is the best. Oh, my God. And I can still repeat it.
Yeah, purposely a place we can't get to.
Exactly.
Heaven forbid we should be happy with ourselves.
Exactly. So I'm interested because most yoga teachers talk about, you know, allowing it and don't push yourself. But it's my experience that many of them can't stay there. You find them slipping into just reach a little bit more, you know. And you pretty much never do that in my experience. And so the class is not only good for the body, but good for the spirit. And there must be a lot of people who also want that because you can't find a square inch of space in your class the days you teach. So I'm really curious about how you got to be who you are, how you developed this way of doing this. This is particularly interesting to me because you're a man, and in our culture, men are generally less able to do that, not more. So I've talked a lot, but maybe I've given you a platform to talk from.
Yeah, I came into yoga as I came in to other things before that, as an antidote, or hopefully an antidote to the suffering that I was going through with depression. It lasted many years, and for some reason I didn't want to medicate it, which today seems absurd. But yoga was one of those things that I came to, and it registered and resonated with me in my body, primarily, the stretching, as opposed to the muscling, which I've done all my life, not necessarily lifting, but working with my hands, arms, and legs. And then the stretching seemed a nice complement to it, and it felt more peaceful. But the yoga that I learned back then never had to do with the breathing part of it, connection to breath. So I started teaching about 15 years ago. I started teaching as I went to the Kripalu Yoga Center in Massachusetts, Lenox, very large, lived there for a month and do the program. It was a very, very nice experience. So I started teaching Kripalu Yoga, which isn't anywhere near as explicit as Iyengar or Ashtanga or Bikram or many of the others, but rather it's a little more subjective. And what happens with all of us, I think, and particularly with me, is that my teaching evolved to meet my own needs. When I'm teaching and speaking to people, I'm really speaking to me as a reminder of what I really want to keep reminding myself of, and yet I still forget it. So I see life as basically a remembering and forgetting. I think I know pretty much all I really need to know to live a really rich, full life. I mean, I think all of us do, basically. But we forget what we know, and we get sucked back into the I'm right, no, I'm right, to the I'm not really okay, I need to change this, and the world really isn't a very safe place. It's really dangerous out there. Those are the thoughts that we grew up with, which I no longer see as true.
But as I think you're pointing out, and not only do we have this as a backlog from our own history, but the world presents this over and over again. You know, it just keeps telling you, you need to do this, you need to do that, you need to have this, you need to be this, you need to go there, it's not enough.
That's right. And of course, we're never enough, and that's what the commercial world is vested in.
Exactly.
Taught to us by people that cared for us, because that's what they thought was the way it was. And so yes, that's the kind of stuff that we're coming with. And until we are able to transform from that into something much more gentle, much more feminine in the true sense, then we're going to continue to suffer in this world of struggle against what is, basically struggling against life to try to force it to be something it's not, to serve us. And the strange and silly part is that even if we got what we really wanted, it wouldn't work. It wouldn't be enough.
No. And we would come right back out into the world, which would happily tell us that it was not enough.
Yeah.
And we needed to be something else or something more. You know, I'm remembering a class, this goes back a little while, where you said that you had recently been teaching a group of people who had never done yoga before, and you told them to look at one another and then look at the mirror. Do you remember?
Yeah.
Will you tell that?
Sure. Big long mirror on one of the walls. Mm-hmm. And what I like to have people do is first to walk around the room and just glance at each other. And while we do that, to just sort of realize that we're not in competition with each other. We're here to have a little fun and maybe to find something that draws us in to do a little more, maybe not. And then I have them stand in front of the mirror and look at themselves, and they start to giggle and snicker. And I say, you know, just take a look at this person and understand that they're going to do this the best they can. And we're not going to compare ourselves to the person you looked at before. And if you're really lucky, you won't compare yourself to the best version in your mind of this person you're looking at in the mirror. So you're going to allow yourself to be who you are in this class and see how it goes.
I was very taken with that and borrowed it and used it, actually, in a workshop I was teaching. It's so the opposite of what we mostly are doing in our daily life. We are in competition with our siblings. We are in competition with our parents. Without intending it, without meaning it, you know, we're in competition in class. They grade on a sliding scale, so everybody can't do well. It starts day one, and it never lets up. So to find even one place where you're encouraged to drop that, you know, to not have to do that, seems to me must be very, very, well, not only compelling to me, but must be compelling to other people as well.
Well, it's certainly compelling to me, Lynn. My notion of life is we're born and we're sort of in a wonderful, playful, child, neutral place, at least for a short time.
Mm-hmm.
And then before we know it, people start letting us know, our parents and others, that we really aren't quite okay the way we are. We have to learn to control our bowels and behave at the dinner table and ultimately to be a certain way, to be popular, to dress a certain way, to be of our kind. And we begin to build little walls around ourselves in the form of shoulds and shouldn'ts, mostly, and what's right and wrong. So these things pile up on us, one on top of the other, And every time we get one, we contract our body a bit. We contract around it. It's a response of, fear is a strong word, but on some level it's a low grade of fear or anxiety that suggests that we got to do it this way or something bad will happen. Somebody won't like us, maybe our parents, teachers. And so we build these shoulds up, and as we keep building them, we keep contracting around them, and we completely lose sight of who we are. If you ask somebody, who are you really, they'll talk about their job or their relationships, how many children they have, or their physical qualities, but we tend to forget who we are. And of course, yoga attempts to rediscover that, as many other paths do. So the yoga that I've developed in response to my own needs, what I'm realizing is that for me, somewhere around age 50 to 55 or 60, somewhere in that span of years, when I first had the experience in yoga of just releasing a muscle, just releasing it and letting it lengthen, it felt very much like an opening, or it's what I call a letting go. And letting go is not something we can try to do. You just can't do it the American way. It has to be allowed. So there has to be space around it of, yes, basically loving or kindness towards towards ourselves and our bodies. And then, because of all the practice, it doesn't happen right away usually. It can or it can't, but usually it takes some time in yoga to get used to the postures, to be comfortable in the postures. So if we're trying to get the postures right, we're defeating it, but we have to learn that first. So then what happens is, I learned to teach yoga basically on the inhaled breath. As I inhale my breath, I reach and I stretch, and I go for it. You know, and even though I'm trying to be non-judgmental, if I'm going for it, I got to be going for something. And so I turn it around. As I was doing my own practice, it occurred to me one day that I'm really talking about the yoga of the exhale breath. Because when I exhale my breath, when I let go of my breath, and sometimes I do it with a or a ah, and that little vibration sort of tricks the body or tempts the body a little more to let go. So in letting go of the breath, we have the intention of letting go of the rigid muscle,
yeah,
or letting go more of a muscle partly opened. And so we keep doing this and get more and more comfortable in letting go. And my paradigm here is that everything that I picked up along the way, all these shoulds and everything, it didn't just come in through the mind, they got stuck in my body. So they are literally embodied. And maybe every cell of my body, I don't really know, but I know it's in there. And so I'm going to use the body as the vehicle of letting go of the things that I no longer want to carry. Most of them in terms of beliefs or perceptions of the world. And the answer to why I want to do that is very simple. I'm so selfish. I want to feel good. I want to feel good. And I don't feel good when I'm in somebody else's voice. And all the shoulds in my life are somebody else's voice. And it isn't that they aren't, not that some of them weren't useful, and maybe they were all useful at the time. I don't know about that. But I made them useful to me in my growth. But they also grew me into a position, into a place in life where I was suffering.
Mm-hmm.
So then I began to look at the other way of it. And it didn't happen overnight, of course. It seldom does, unless you're going to have a near-death experience. I keep trying to have one, but so far I haven't managed to do it.
We're delighted.
But that's the transformative experience we hear about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the word transform is powerful for me because I'm not just looking for a little improvement. I'm really too selfish and hoggish for that. I want to transform this feeling of contraction, this sort of tightness and tied-inness where I close off my shoulders, I close off my heart, and shorten my breath. I want to transform that into the openness of wide open heart, chest, face, and body. And so I get this not by trying to get it, but by trusting that it's there. I want to let go of this because I'm trusting that when I let go of it, what I'm going to fall into is good.
Yes.
If I let go of something, I'm going to fall somewhere. I'm going to go somewhere, at least in a spiritual sense or a psychological sense. So I have to trust that what I'm going to fall into is good. And that's an act of faith. And
yes,
it takes courage to let go of the known and maybe find out what's in the unknown. But what I experienced, and what many people seem to, is that when we let go of that tightness, what we do is we fall into this softness. It's almost like warm water that just surrounds us, and it's sweet. It feels like kindness and acceptance and love.
And safe.
And safe, thank you. That's an excellent word. If we don't start with safe, we don't get anywhere.
I think that's right, and I think that what stops people from doing that is the fear that it won't be safe.
That's right.
Clients will often say to me about whatever it is scaring them or hurting them or that they want to do differently or that they do in some way that they would prefer not to do. Mm-hmm. They will say, is this normal? Have you seen this before? Does anybody else have this? That terror.
That loneliness in it.
Exactly. And I always say, you can't be anything that the rest of us aren't. You're just a human being. You can't have anything that's not human.
Right.
You know, so if you're doing it, somebody else, maybe everybody else is. You don't have to be ashamed.
Good point, yeah.
In a way, it's all the same thing, you know, that we're, even in yoga, going there trying to be something, you know.
Yeah. Until we're not.
Until we're not. Exactly.
I used to say smile a lot. I say it less now.
Mm-hmm.
Because I honestly understand that people who are in pain at that moment, it feels terribly intrusive to have somebody say smile, because I can't do it right now. So I've taken to using the word soften your face.
I have noticed it.
And when I say soften the face, I mean, you say it enough, people sort of get it, just release the muscles and let the face be just soft. And if it's soft, really soft, the jaws and the eyes and the forehead particularly, then you get to notice that the rest of the body softens some too, and that's because the face is the periscope. Looking out onto the world, and the body's the submarine, and if the periscope is smiling, the body says, well, it must be safe out there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's okay to let go of some of this fear, and it generally does, or it has a better chance to do it. You know, we are what we are in this moment, and if we can't bring enough awareness, consciousness, kindness, trust to that moment, then we're not going to be able to let go, and sometimes that's true. So if I'm awake, I'm saying to people, let go as best you can right now.
Yes.
And maybe the next breath you'll let go a little more, but let that be okay.
Yeah.
Let it be okay. In other words, if you can't let go right now, then let go of the need to let go.
Yes.
Because then you're going to feel like a failure, and you're not a failure.
Well, you can't possibly be a failure at being yourself.
But you can feel like a
yes,
failure.
That's right. But that's, of course, the dichotomy, that so often we're feeling something that is blatantly untrue.
Right.
I wonder if you would mind talking a little bit about the journey that yoga helped you take from depression.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you sort of alluded to it, but can you say something more about that?
Yes. What I learned by watching myself in meditation, and formal and informal, is I've never had to work. I've chosen a lifestyle and job style which has left me a lot of free time. So I've had time to be with myself, and I've taken it, not tried to fill it up all the time. So what I've noticed is that when I'm starting to suffer, be in pain, be afraid, all those terms, suffer is strong, but it's an umbrella word. When I'm starting to feel poorly, I feel it in my body. I feel a sense of constriction. I can feel that my breath is moving shallow rather than deep. My eyes may be a little bit creased, and my jaw may be tight, my musculature. And I've found that by paying attention to my body, I can apprehend that earlier. And as soon as I apprehend it, okay, then, because I also have learned before that my suffering, my fear, my anxiety is never due to the events or the people that appear to cause it.
Mm-hmm.
Never. It's always due. And this is too strong perhaps, but let's say it's almost always due to my perception of it. What I discovered was that the closer attention I pay to my body, the sooner I can apprehend the perception that's causing the contraction in my body. And then I can, it gets easier and easier to realize that it's not that out there. It's not that person or that event. It's not the bad golf shot or the pneumonia. or the broken leg, or the car that won't start. It's never that. It's always me. What we're trying to do here then, those of us that are working in this arena and believing in it, we're trying to change the beliefs that we're stuck with so that we're no longer stuck with them or stuck less often, which is basically the way I see it. I don't expect to completely lose the beliefs I've had for 60 or 70 years. I don't expect to do that. But I do expect or hope to be able to identify them early in my process of experience and to be able to consciously make a choice to shift. In the yoga, the practice is letting go of the body, letting go of the muscles that have been tight sometimes all of our lives and sometimes just for a while. And we let go time after time with our practice until we get more and more comfortable relaxing and releasing into a posture. There are some nice physical techniques. Years ago, I read a book called What to Say When You Talk to Yourself. A guy named Hemstetler, I still remember. And so he said, make an audio tape for yourself and put on it everything you'd like to believe about yourself. And I did it, and I put it in my car, and I listened to it whenever I went anywhere. Put it out right in the middle, start both ways, and I just had it going. And, you know, at first, you know, everything in my life is unfolding perfectly, and I would listen to it, and I'd say, I don't think so. And so you get to notice the resistance to that. Mm-hmm. Because you're paying attention, or, you know, if we're lucky, we pay attention to that. And then, again, go back to the process of letting go. If I find myself with a belief that I'm not enough, or which of course I do, then very softly I breathe into that belief. Take two or three breaths and really sort of enfold it in my breath. Enfold it with gentleness and love and exhale it out. Give it back to the universe.
Well, you do the same thing that you would do for others. You love it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yes, you love the things that caused you pain or appeared to cause you pain because they were the path to your awakening.
Yes.
And they were somebody's best idea of what was good for me.
And because fighting it won't work.
Exactly. You know, that famous saying, what we resist persists. And it's so true. Mm-hmm. And what we can feel, mm-hmm. then we can heal.
Yeah.
To feel it. That's the key, isn't it? To be able to feel it and not be afraid.
And not be afraid. I think that is the key.
It takes great courage.
Yes. And it's my experience that it's very difficult to do alone.
Mine too.
And so it really is finding a teacher or a process or somebody that you trust who says, this will be all right. You will be safe. It's okay to do. And, of course, you have to believe that person. You have to trust them. That makes it possible for most of us. It's what you were saying about needing to be connected.
Yes.
So I think that is a gift that you give. And whether everybody in the room is ready to get it or seems to be getting it, I think probably many more than you know are. And also, you are making it possible for them. You're presenting it. And that's really, it seems...
Planting a seed, perhaps.
Even if that's it, you are certainly doing that. So, as somebody who has really enjoyed your class, I want to say thank you for all of us, and also for this interview. Is there anything that you want to say that we maybe didn't touch on?
Yeah. You mentioned that it's hard to do alone. That's true. So, I mention that to people all the time, and I say, first find somebody that you resonate with. Make them a friend, and talk about this stuff. And when you're with somebody that seems available, speak as though you believed it. Speak as though you did. And let them knock you down with it, because they probably will. I've been knocked down 1,000 times by arguments that sounded at the time to be better than mine. But I stayed with it because something in me resonated. So you need somebody else, and you also need time alone. Time alone to do the practice. The mm-hmm. practice, whatever, the various forms, for me the practice is to sit still, watch my breath, deepen the breath without struggling, and then go inside where the breath is taking me. And resonate with that place, and remember what it is that I know to be true. The other thing, you're seeking a teacher, let the world know you're seeking a teacher. And one at a time, or two at a time, because your teacher today, you'll outgrow tomorrow, there'll be somebody else. And one final thing about what it is I do in a yoga class, it's very important for me to realize that while people may get some benefit out of what I'm doing, it sounds terrible, but I'm not really doing it for them first. I'm doing it for me. And the best gift that they give me is their presence. So I always say thank you for coming. And what I mean is, because you're here, I get to say right out loud to all you people what I think I truly believe. Mm-hmm. And I listen for how it sounds. And I couldn't do it without you. I can't say it to the trees. That doesn't make any sense. But when I risk, and it's no longer a risk for me, at first it was a huge risk saying it a little bit at a time, but say it out loud. Mm-hmm. Share it. Teach it.
Those are wonderful things to take away. And I do think that it is that not only you believe it, but you're living it in the minute, mm-hmm. that makes it powerful for other people. So that's that odd irony, that the more you give it away, the more you get it.
Funny that I've come to trust, really trust selfishness, mm-hmm. but not the way the word is usually meant. I would reframe it as enlightened or thoughtful self-interest. Because if I'm really, really paying attention to what I want, it's always those rich things that we talk about, peace and joy and safety and love. And those things not only don't hurt anybody else, but being in the presence of that is nurturing to others as
That's
well
right.
as myself.
That's right. So the more you get it, the more you're giving it away.
So always ask the question, what is it I really want? Don't ever ask the question, what should I do? Is that somebody else's voice?
Absolutely. Oh, well. Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you, Lynn.
I didn't realize when I decided to repeat Charlie's interview for this show what a perfect lead-in it was going to be for what I'm talking about. But I do believe in synchronicity. So, synchronistically speaking, Charlie talks a lot, as you heard, about using your own voice. You know, he talks in terms of shoulds, that if you're saying, I should do, then you're not in your voice, you're in someone else's voice. And really, everything that I have talked about in this show and how I'm going to end it is all about finding your voice, finding who is really you, and not who you thought you had to be, decided you had to be, were pretending to be. So the last piece of the how do I find who I am part of what I'm talking about is to look for your cover story and what it is you have had to hide undercover. The cover story is made up of all of those things which you decided you had to be when you were a child. All of the things I talked about at the beginning of the show are the way you decide what your cover story is. And a cover story, very much like a spy, right, has a cover story. Those things may be true of you. In fact, for us, our cover stories generally are true of us. They are things that we are. The problem is they're not the whole story. And we think they are. In fact, those pieces of you, those qualities of yours, which you think of as you and which I would describe as your cover story, the opposite qualities almost certainly exist in what I have labeled undercover. We've hidden them from sight, much the way a spy has to hide aspects of themselves so that they will not be discovered, because discovery will put them in danger. So we hide aspects of ourselves because discovery of them will either embarrass us, get us punished, get us into some kind of trouble, or cause some kind of discomfort in our family. Again, it's fairly obvious that later in life you may very well need some of these qualities which you have put undercover. You will need to recover them. And it's difficult to do if you have come to think of these qualities as unattractive, ugly, dangerous, which is how we come to think of them when we put them under cover. Again, a good way to find your cover story is to look at your pie piece and see what you wrote there. What you wrote there is what you think you had to be, and therefore your cover story. And a good way to find your undercover is to look at those qualities that you wrote in the pie pieces of other family members. Remember earlier I was saying that I believe that every quality that exists in a family exists in all of its members. So the chances are good that whatever you wrote in the pie pieces of other family members, however much you may despise those qualities, are also yours, and you have them undercover. If the time comes when you need to be able to act irresponsibly or selfishly or timidly or aggressively, and those qualities belong to other members of your family and you think of them as unpleasant or ugly or dangerous, remember that all qualities can be described in positive and negative ways. Okay, I probably even have run over here, but I want to say, as I have said often and will continue to say, that all of this information exists in the book and in the workbook and in the audiobook. And you can download the workbook from the website, and you can buy a hardcover of the book from me on the website. You can also buy a hardcover, hard copy of the workbook from me on the website. And the podcasts are all up now, I believe. I don't know if I've said that before. The podcasts are all up, and you can download them at some point. I'm going to charge for them. Well, maybe I won't. In any case, they're free now. So if there's any show previously, you can download it. Well, okay. I guess I have to stop. but not before I thank once again my IT guy, Josh Hackney. I'm sorry I'm not going to be able to say all the wonderful things I like to say about him because I don't have time. But you can find him by emailing me or going up on my website and writing to me. And now I'm just going to say goodbye for now. I will be here again next week, and I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time,
But it ain't over yet, 'cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper, I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten